It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. North Korea is testing its ballistic or guided missiles again, this in violation of the UN Security Council. Last week's test sent shockwaves around the world. President Biden says he agrees with former President Obama that North Korea is the most important foreign policy issue he faces. What does a nuclear-armed North Korea mean for the world? It has the fourth largest military. We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. David Fields is the Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, where he teaches. He's the author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. David, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by understanding North Korea. And I understand you actually took a trip there a decade ago.
Yes, that's correct. I visited North Korea in August of 2010 as a part of a delegation of American academics trying to get a better understanding of the place.
Why did you want to visit?
I had been studying U.S.-Korean relations for about 3 years at that point. I was a graduate student. I had lived in South Korea for 2 years. And, you know, I'd been studying it, but there's no substitute for actually going there and actually seeing the things on the ground. And it was about 11 years ago today that the ROK warship, the Cheonanham, had been sunk. And I was talking with my advisor about the situation, and he was saying, man, I really wish I could find out what it was like in North Korea. And I said, well, if you find me the funding, I will find a way to get there. And he said, if you can find a way to get there, I can definitely find some funding for you to go. And one thing led to another, and then I ended up getting to visit.
So what was it like?
It is easily the most depressing place I've ever been on Earth. And I've been to very poor places before. I've spent time doing development work in Ciudad Juarez in northern Mexico. I've spent significant time in Central America. So I'd been to poor places before. But what's different about North Korea is in these other societies, you see that they're societies that are waiting for their turn for development to come. What you see in North Korea is you actually see a society that had been quite developed. We often lose sight of the fact that for most of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, North Korea was more developed than South Korea. And so when you see North Korean poverty today, you see poverty that has been imposed on people by their regime. You see a regime that has allowed much of the country to just lapse into poverty while it focuses on the structures and on the people that will keep its own, that will keep itself in power indefinitely. So it's a different kind of power. It's a different kind of poverty than you see other places. And this looks like infrastructure that has been completely allowed to decay, housing stock where a lot of people live without windows, power poles without any wire because the wire has been stripped and probably sold for scrap. So it's a very, very different and depressing kind of poverty.
Is that because the regime is spending their money on their military?
That is a big part of it. But there's another part of it. And I think, and many scholars agree, that the regime has actually embraced underdevelopment as a means of controlling its people. So they take the 3 or 4 million people who are essential to the functioning of the North Korean state. They live in Pyongyang. They have, you know, their needs provided for. They do not starve. They have heat in the wintertime, and they've taken the rest of the country and they've kept them in a state of underdevelopment in rural communities, doing agricultural labor, backbreaking agricultural labor, because that makes them easier to control. It's hard to imagine alternatives to the current regime when you are spending 14 hours a day doing agricultural labor for the state and also trying to provide for your own subsistence. Surviving is basically the full-time job of about 60 to 70% of North Koreans. And it really makes them much less of a threat to a very brutal regime.
And what's the perception of the United States or Americans? How do they view us?
Not good, but like many people, and I should say that when I was in North Korea, I was very limited in the number of North Koreans I could talk to. I was surrounded by minors except for one case when I was there. And I knew that that would be the case going in there. So I actually spent a lot of my whole purpose in going there was to talk to my minders as much as possible and to find out if they actually believed the regime propaganda or if this was something that, you know, they would just parrot. And so I talked to them a lot about their views of the United States. And actually, they had fairly sophisticated views and they understood the difference between the American government and the American people. So they were very polite to me and were very reassuring that they have no beef with the American people. It's the policies of the American government that they really object to. And they really believe and they're taught that the United States is bent on the destruction of North Korea as a state and that they have to be kept in a constant state of military mobilization to meet this threat from the United States. And it's important to understand that this is the ideology that really animates North Korea right now. It is not a communist ideology in which they try to secure a basic subsistence living for their people. It's a society where they understand that they all live in poverty, that they all live in very difficult circumstances, but they are taught and they believe that this is necessary to keep their society in this level of military mobilization to defend themselves against the United States and other foreign powers who want to destroy them as a people. And it's a very terrifying thing to see up close. It's essentially a nationwide xenophobia that is keeping North Korea going at this point.
Well, and I want to talk about those policies, starting most recently with the Trump administration, the first U.S. president to visit. What do you think his strategy accomplished?
I don't think it accomplished really very much. I don't think it accomplished anything besides a momentary pause in what has been a very troubled relationship. It was notable in that it de-escalated the incredible tensions of 2017 of the fire and fury phase. Mm-hmm. But we also need to keep in mind that it was largely President Trump who initiated those tensions with really unprecedented rhetoric coming out of Washington towards North Korea. So I think it was really ineffective. The question is why? And I think there's two interpretations of why President Trump's approach was ineffective. There's the cynical interpretation that, in fact, that having the two summits was the point. That was what he wanted, and that's what Kim Jong-un wanted, that both understood there was no basis for a deal there, but they had a lot to gain by engaging in the summitry. For President Trump, it was a chance to look like the great American statesman on the world stage. It was a chance to claim, at least temporarily, that he had succeeded where every other American president had failed. And for Kim Jong-un, it was a chance to look like the leader of a normal state, engaging in bilateral meetings with the most powerful leader in the world. So that's the cynical interpretation, and I think that's somewhat true. I think there's a more generous interpretation as well, which is that Donald Trump really believed that Kim Jong-un was interested in economic development and that he would trade his nuclear weapons program for a fundamentally different relationship with the United States, a less confrontational relationship, one in which North Korea could get some sanctions relief, possibly aid for development. And Donald Trump felt that if he established warm relations with Kim Jong-un, that might be possible. I think it's pretty clear what happened in Hanoi when they sat down and started talking is that Kim Jong-un made clear that he just wanted a small deal. He wanted a small freeze in North Korea's weapons program in return for American sanctions relief. And Donald Trump looked at that deal and walked away. And I think that that was probably the right thing to do at the time. And I think to understand the situation, you probably need to understand both interpretations. There was a cynical aspect to this, and then there was also a genuine aspect to this at the same time. But ultimately, there was no possibility for a deal in which North Korea fundamentally eliminates their nuclear weapons program.
We're speaking with David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. And we're talking about North Korea. Do you worry about North Korea having nuclear weapons? What do you think the U.S. should do? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. David, I want to talk about those tests last week. What do you understand that they were testing?
I should say I'm primarily a historian and not a specialist in pensions.
Sure.
But it seems pretty clear that what they were, the tests were significant and that they were testing a new type of guided missile technology that they had not had previously. And that the nature of the technology is such that it would be very difficult to defend against with the current anti-missile defense systems that are available in the ROK. It's also important to understand, though, that the missiles that they were testing last week were not the kind of missiles that could reach the United States. They're fairly short-range missiles, so they would be a threat to the ROK and Japan. But this particular system, outside of American servicemen on the Korean Peninsula, of which there are about 28,000, would not be a threat to the continental United States. However, I think it's only a matter of time before they go back to testing those sorts of systems as well, intercontinental ballistics systems, and also additional nuclear weapons tests. So I should say, too, that these are not tests that surprised anybody. This is what the North Koreans do. Kim Jong-un had mentioned that they were developing new types of missile technologies in his address to the 8th Party Plenum in January of this year. And so these are tests that no one knew when they were coming, but they'd been expected for some time.
Didn't a similar thing happen at the beginning of the Trump administration?
Yes. And actually, March is a fairly common time for these sorts of tests. And so one of the questions about these tests whenever they occur is, are these tests in response to something that's happening in the international realm, or are these tests just a result of when the North Koreans like to schedule them? They're often doing military exercises in March. And so it would make sense that they would test new weapon systems at that time as well. So it's possible that these tests were in response to, you know, high-level meetings between the U.S. and ROK leaders last week, resumption of U.S.-ROK joint military exercises this past March. Or it's possible that the North Koreans had scheduled these, you know, 6 months in advance, and this is just the date that they chose.
And so how has South Korea responded?
South Korea, their relationship with North Koreans is quite interesting. And I think it's actually very hard for Americans to understand this, that the primary lens that they see North Korea through is not one of a national security threat, but one of a great national tragedy. The division of Korea in 1945 was not a Korean idea. It was a decision that was imposed upon the Korean Peninsula by the United States and the Soviet Union. The Koreans did play a role in that division becoming permanent over the subsequent years. But I'd like to ask, especially Wisconsin audiences, to imagine tomorrow that Wisconsin was divided down the I-39 corridor. And for the next several decades, you would have no contact with people on the other side. And you would be told that the people on the other side of that division were very, very dangerous. And so I'm from the La Crosse area, but I have, you know, family in Green Bay. And we would be told for decades that these people on the other side were dangerous and that they were a threat to us. And there might even be evidence that that's true. But at the same time, you would think, well, these are my family members. These are people that I know, and we're all Wisconsinites. I mean, we all root for the Packers. We all eat cheese curds. We have all of these things in common, and you would feel quite conflicted about it. And that's really the way South Korea feels about North Korea. They understand that North Korea is dangerous. They understand it's a threat to them, but they also believe that these are their ethnic kin. And really, they're almost more to be pitied than they are to be feared. And so the South Korean response to these tests, as is often the case, is quite mute. You get a much more vigorous response from the United States and from Japan.
Yeah, and I saw that President Biden announced that he would not be visiting and he would not be speaking or engaging with Kim Jong-un. What do you think the U.S. should do?
I think that is exactly the strategy that the United States should be taking at this moment. The last thing that we want is for North Korean nuclear weapons to be perceived as a problem in the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and the DPRK, because these weapons are not just a threat to the United States. They're a threat to everyone in the region. and they're a threat to the entire international community. So I don't think we want to get ahead of the international community ourselves the way Donald Trump did and try to solve this problem on our own, because I don't think that there's any solution to this problem in the short or medium term. And I don't think that we want to be responsible for not being able to solve it. When you have a problem like this that's so intractable that there's no obvious solution to, I think you want to share the burden, that you want to work with your allies, that you want to work with the international community as much as possible. I think it's so important to understand that since 2006, since the first North Korean nuclear test, every single UN sanction, every single UN resolution that has condemned North Korea for this and has placed sanctions on the regime has been unanimous. That includes votes from China and Russia. And basically, the international community is saying, we can't keep you from developing nuclear weapons, but we can make sure that the cost of doing that is high. And I think the United States should stay in that multilateral framework and say, we cannot solve this. We cannot stop you, but we can make sure that the entire international community is united in opposing you. And that's what most, nearly all American presidents had done, except Donald Trump, who, you know, went out on his own and tried to solve this problem. And if it would have worked, it would have been great. In some ways, it was a wonderful natural experiment in U.S. DPRK relations to see if warm relations between the two leaders at the top could lead to some kind of breakthrough. And it seems apparent that it couldn't. And so now I think it's time to go back to the normal multilateral strategy. I mean, we should have no illusions about this. It's not going to provide any solution in the short or medium term, but I still think it's the right thing to do.
Right. But this has been decades of policy with Korea that has not prevented the development of nuclear weapons programs. I mean, what needs to change, do you think?
I don't think that there's anything that can change. I think given enough time and the will to do it, a state like North Korea can get the material it needs. It can develop the expertise that it needs to develop this kind of system. It's also important to understand that since really the 1960s, North Korea has held the entire city of Seoul hostage through just conventional artillery. So there's never really been a nuclear option with dealing or a military option for dealing with North Korea that did not risk the entire city of Seoul, which, you know, currently more than 20 million people live in. So because of these factors of geography and because of North Korea's determination to do this, there really is not a way to stop them. And I know nobody wants to hear that, but I think that's the case. So I think really all an American president can do and the international community can do is signal to the North Koreans, we cannot stop you from doing this, but we can keep the costs of doing this as high as possible. And it's pretty obvious that the North Koreans are bridling about that. Kim Jong-un is desperate for economic development, although I should say when he says economic development, he's meaning economic development for Pyongyang and not for the entire country.
Yeah. So what does he want?
He wants to trade a small segment of their nuclear weapons program in returns for sanctions relief. Okay, so maybe a freeze on testing, you know, a formal agreement that he would not test nuclear weapons in perpetuity for, you know, a certain amount of relief from UN and US sanctions, or a moratorium on development of certain type of missile technologies. I think one of the ways you can look at the test last week is North Korea trying to add more weapons to its arsenal in hope that they can get the United States and the international community to make a trade, but not a trade for their entire program. They're not going to give up the entire program. A trade for some capability in which they get sanctions relief for agreeing not to do X or Y anymore. And that's what he offered Donald Trump in Hanoi, and Donald Trump walked away from it. And I'm convinced that the North Koreans would make that kind of deal basically any time. But it's actually the international community who has said, no, your entire weapons program is the problem, and we're not going to cut a deal until you agree to complete verifiable and irreversible denuclearization.
Right. So not just a bargaining chip to be played for some smaller change.
Exactly.
Well, David, we will keep an eye on this. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you again for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be on WPR.
Thank you. David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, where he teaches. He's the author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism, and the Division of Korea. Up next is news, and then we'll learn about a Chicago suburb's effort to provide reparations to descendants of people affected by racist housing policies. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. I want to take you back to Monday, April 29th, 1968. Little more than 3 weeks since Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, the Evanston City Council votes to pass a new fair housing ordinance. It banned discrimination in the sale or lease of homes in Evanston. This after decades of redlining. Historians documenting Evanston banks refusing to issue mortgages to black households in certain neighborhoods, builders not selling property to black households in those areas, and white homeowners putting covenants on their homes so they could only be sold, leased, or occupied by whites. Fast forward to today. The Evanston City Council has now allocated $10 million to help its black residents with housing and mortgage relief. It's giving grants to help residents put down a down payment on a house, pay down the mortgage, do home repairs. The program is being called the first of its kind in the country. And here to tell us about it is Ron Daniels, the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. How do you see the movement for reparations? We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you? Tell us about this fund and why. Why Evanston decided to create this.
Well, you laid the background out very strongly in terms of the history of redlining in that city. We were fortunate to have a very courageous and visionary alderman, Robin Rue Simmons. Residents there had actually built on some previous work that had been done by Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste and others coming off of the Durban Conference. And she concluded, looking at how the black community was underdeveloped and how it was actually losing residents and so forth, that the only way to close the wealth gap and to have any meaningful opportunity to repair the black community was through reparations. And so she was able to persuade the council to at least pass a resolution initially to allocate $10 million over 10 years towards that goal. The issue was how to get it done, and we were blessed to have her appeal and come to the National African American Reparations Commission. And so we were deeply involved in helping to put together the process, the criteria, the definitions to make sure that Evanston would be a model, frankly, for reparations across the country. So it is a first in that there are some cities that have talked about doing reparations, and this is all a good motion these days. But it was Evanston that really finally actually did it. And it did it through a vote for this restorative, reparative housing project, which will allocate really $400,000, an initial $400,000, up to $25,000 per awardee. It looks like about 16 families or individuals will be able to take advantage of this program. But that's not the only – housing will not be the only program. It's the first program, and again, over 10 years, there'll be $10 million, which, frankly, is not a great deal of money, but it's a very important beginning, and it sends a signal to other cities across the country that is what's possible. And frankly, the whole world on last Monday was looking at Evanston, Illinois, because it is a milestone, and we're very proud of the work that Robin Ruth Simmons and all the stakeholders who came together in a city like Evanston that has this liberal reputation. And it just shows, and I'm not saying that negatively, it just shows you that even in a city like that with Northwestern University, you have this history of exclusion and disinvestment in black communities in a way that was very harmful.
Well, how does the city decide who qualifies?
Well, and first of all, let me also say that the revenue, which is always, is important, will come from the taxes on recreational marijuana. As you well know, in Illinois, marijuana has been legalized, and there's a tax on it, and revenues can go to local communities. And it was what I call sort of righteous irony, righteous justice, frankly, that it was the black community, black and brown communities, that bore the brunt of the war on drugs. And so nothing more appropriate than to have actually the revenue from recreational marijuana go to actually doing the repair. They have a system in place that will identify families as, you know, and there, I saw the records. We saw the records. There are individual families, individual houses. I mean, so the descendants of people who were affected or the actual people who were affected up through 1969 will be eligible to apply, and they'll be vetted. And I'm sure there are many more, hopefully, that they'll be able to get down the line. But there'll be a process for identifying those families, and those awards will be made. Now, obviously, one of the concerns is that the pool is small. So one of the other things that's been provided for is the development of a community fund, an Evanston Community Finance Authority, under the auspices initially of the Evanston Community Foundation, a 501c3, which will allow for the city to put resources into that fund, but also for private individuals and corporations to also donate in a way to help expand the ultimate possibilities of the fund, of the reparations initiative.
We're speaking with Ron Daniels, the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. Back in a flash. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with Ron Daniels, the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. And we're talking about a new program in Evanston to help black residents with home ownership. It's being called the first reparation program in the nation to directly address and attempt to atone for the legacy of racism. What do you think? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. Ron, I wonder, I saw an opinion piece in the Washington Post the other day that that critiqued this effort, that said, you know, it's a housing voucher program. It's not full scale reparations. It does not really provide closure for injustice. What do you say to that?
Well, unfortunately, William Sandy Darity is an expert in the wealth gap. Probably does some really good work there, but he's really not an expert on reparations. That's why we have a National African American Reparations Commission that can certify what is reparations and what is not reparations. I mean, reparations is simply repair, as defined by international law. It is the repair for damages, harm inflicted upon a group or an organization, an entity, in terms of physical, mental, spiritual destruction, identity, and so therefore, what we're looking at in terms of African Americans is just that. It's for enslavement initially, but all of the derivative racially exclusionary policies that happen thereafter. I won't cite them all, but the Homestead Act, the GI Bill, FHA, and redlining certainly qualifies as such. And so the principles are that when there's an injury, the party must acknowledge, the party that inflicts the harm must acknowledge, apologize, and then there must be a remedy. And in Evanston, they have acknowledged, they apologized, and they've made a remedy. The principle here is that the party that inflicts the harm cannot define the remedy. It has to be done by the aggrieved party. In this instance, the aggrieved party, through hearings and town hall meetings, came up with a solution, particularly for this housing program. They wanted housing. And so now the grants are being made. It meets all of the definitions for reparations. Professor Daugherty has also said, well, but this is going to be a detraction from the national effort. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is actually complementary of the national effort. Where he is correct at one level is the resources at the local level across the country, including states like California that have also passed a H.R. 40 type resolution with bipartisan support signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. These will not be sufficient in terms of the amount of resources. The trillions of dollars that will be required to ultimately repair, and really no amount can really repair, because that can begin to close the gap, will have to be done at the federal level.
Right, Ron, I just wonder, how do you put a price tag on something like this?
You can't, and then that's why I qualified it by saying that. But having said that, you know, I mean, one of the things that becomes incredibly important to state is, even in Evanston, wealth was generated. Somebody profited and benefited from the disinvestment in these communities. One community was harmed. Other communities benefited from that in terms of the location of business districts and residential districts and so forth. And it's the wealth, not only the physical destruction, which in and of itself is horrific. It is the fact that in this country, a racialized capitalist system was built off of the wealth of enslaved labor. And beyond that, if you look at the convict lease system and you go on and on and on and on. So there's no price that could be put on that. But the great thing about reparations is, as Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, our courageous leader on H.R. 40, which is about to pass, is about to become the law of the land, it is only reparations that has the potential for cleansing the soul of America of its original sins, one of its original sins. The other you referenced in your piece, your excellent piece about the tribal leader, indigenous leader who succumbed to COVID. That is still a sin that has not yet been fully repaired. The other is enslavement and all of the impacts from that. We have got to make this nation better. It will be better when it confronts the legacy of enslavement and the embedding of systemic institutional racism, you know, which is a fact of life. And so this is what reparations ultimately will do. But it will be the federal legislation that will make the greatest strides towards that possibility.
Right. So where you mentioned H.R. 40, this bill before Congress, where are we at with that?
Well, where we are is that a bill that was first put forth by the Honorable John Conyers, now, God rest his soul, deceased, but one of the great architects of progressive legislation, architect of the H.R. of the Martin Luther King bill, among others, introduced a bill in 1989. It was essentially seen as a study bill to really be used as an organizing tool to get people on board with it. It never had more than 50 sponsors. In the last Congress, it had 173 in the House of Representatives. It had more than 20 on the Senate side, introduced by Senator Cory Booker. And one of the signatories is our current Vice President, Kamala Harris. We are now getting ready to go to a markup and a floor vote, and we have close to 175 as of last week, going towards 190. There are 19 co-sponsors in the Senate, supported by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, the Senate Majority Leader, is also on board. This bill is moving towards actually becoming the law of the land. The problem will be the Senate, where you have the filibuster, the 60-vote rule. But President Biden, respecting the power of the black vote and also respecting the urgency of the moment. We're in a moment of great inflection in this country. The George Floyd trial just began, or the not his trial, but the trial of the officer that in this public lynching that we saw just, you know, began yesterday, and, you know, which precipitated one of the greatest mass movements in the history of this country, not just black people, not just brown people, millions of people, many of whom were white in rural areas all over this country, beginning to say, we have to change this country, and reparations is going to be the cornerstone of the cleansing and the creation of the possibilities of a new America.
Ron, but we're speaking with Ron Daniels, the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. What do you say to folks? I'm sure you've talked to folks who say, that wasn't me. That happened so long ago, and I was not responsible. Why should I pay?
Well, yeah, ask me, and we're not asking people individually to pay anyway, but this, it is a great question. And the fact that we have to answer that question speaks to the whitewashing of American education. And that's why, again, H.R. 40 and processes like Evanston become so important. And I was just in your segment, I was just moved by your segment. People have to be educated about what happened in history. And so it is the case that, you know, you may not have been directly responsible. But there's I would commend to our people a book by Trina Brown called Traces of the Trade. And she does an excellent job of coming forward to talk about her family and how it benefited from the trafficking and the slave trade. But not just the trafficking. It's like the multiplier effect. You didn't have to be directly involved to benefit from it, in terms of the jobs that were generated, the wealth that was generated. Now, in a racialized, capitalist society, those who were at the top benefited most. But it trickled down to really create all kinds of opportunities for white people in general. And so it's not a personal indictment. And at the end of the day, it is about what was done in the name of the nation. The United States of America was complicit. Not all and every person in Evanston, Illinois, had any direct or indirect engagement. But the city did, and the city benefited, and by benefiting, it also meant that its residents benefited. So that's a way of looking at it. And if people took that kind of attitude and that kind of positive view about it, it's really not about trying to take away. In fact, at the end of the day, when communities are healed and you have the building out of greater wealth in these communities and greater opportunities, the entire nation will benefit. All of us will be better, because we will have addressed these issues and we'll have actually made progress on them. And let me just say that – I'm sorry.
Oh, I wanted to let you know that we had a caller, Winston from Chippewa Falls, and their mother lives in Evanston and wants to know more about this program. And I will say we put a link on our website at WPR.org/mornings, WPR.org/mornings. But – any resources? We're up against the clock, but any resources for folks to find out more?
Right. They go to the IBW website, website IBW21, that's 21.org. We have the most extensive online reparations resource center in the world on our website, IBW21.org.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. And that was Ron Daniel, the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. Just ahead, we're going to look at lagging diversity in Wisconsin's teacher workforce and efforts underway to address it. Do your teachers look like the communities they serve? Join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.